From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, rock, pop, jazz, and Bart Simpson. We talk with Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, Futurama, and the syndicated strip Life in Hell. Groening used to be a rock critic. Now he's edited the 2003 edition of an anthology collecting the year's best music writing. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead recommends some CDs for holiday gifts, collections by Count Basie, Thelonious Monk, and the Modern Jazz Quartet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House is criticizing a U.S. appeals court ruling that the administration has no authority to hold Jose Padilla as an enemy combatant. Padilla has been accused of plotting to detonate a so-called dirty bomb. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Padilla has been held since May of 2002 when he was picked up at O'Hare Airport in Chicago upon arriving from Pakistan. The U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan says the military must release him within 30 days and transfer him to civilian authorities who could bring charges. The White House spokesman, Scott McClellan, called the ruling, quote, troubling and flawed.
The president has directed the Justice Department to seek a stay and further judicial review. This is a case in which an individual was involved with terrorist organization activity and was actively engaged in an effort to do harm to the American people.
McClellan says the president has directed the Justice Department to seek a stay of the ruling and to appeal the decision. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Meanwhile, a federal appeals court in San Francisco ruled that the prisoners held at the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, should have access to lawyers and American courts. In a 2-1 ruling, the court said the government doesn't have the authority to deny the more than 600 prisoners in the camp any legal means of challenging their captivity. The Bush administration has said the men are enemy combatants and, as such, have no right to legal representation. Most of the men were captured in Afghanistan 2 years ago and are suspected of having fought for Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. The Supreme Court has already agreed to hear arguments on whether the prisoners should have access to American courts. A jury in Chesapeake, Virginia, has found Lee Boyd Malvo guilty on 2 capital murder counts. Malvo was charged in the killing of Linda Franklin, who was shot in a Virginia parking lot in October of last year. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Malvo was 17 at the time of the killing, one of 10 deaths attributed to him and John Allen Muhammad in the Washington area in October 2002. His attorneys argued Malvo had been brainwashed by the 42-year-old Muhammad, leaving him with a mental illness and unable to tell right from wrong. Muhammad was convicted of 2 capital murder counts last month. Prosecutors argued Malvo and Muhammad were 2 peas in a pod, as they put it, motivated by greed, pointing to a $10 million demand to stop the shootings. Prosecutors played for jurors a taped interview with Malvo in which he confessed to carrying out several of the sniper shootings. Now the penalty phase of the trial begins, in which jurors will hear further testimony and recommend whether the now 18-year-old should be sentenced to death. Brian Naylor, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 102 points to close at 10,248. The Nasdaq gained 34 points to close at 1,956. This is NPR News. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a fiscal crisis in the state and assumed emergency powers to cut spending and appropriate money without legislative approval. Schwarzenegger ordered payments to cities and counties to make up for the more than $300 million in revenue that they've lost since he cut the state's car tax. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service scientists say the Army Corps of Engineers needs to change the way it operates dams on the Missouri River in order to save an endangered species. Matt Hackworth reports from member station KCUR in Kansas City.
The Wildlife Service's opinion says cutting the flow of the dam-controlled Missouri River will help the endangered pallid sturgeon reproduce and survive. The barge and farming industries oppose changing the river's flow, saying the shallow water will kill commercial barge traffic on the lower Missouri River. But Chad Smith of the conservation group American Rivers says cutting the flow into spring and fall shipping seasons won't mean the end of shipping on the Missouri.
We've had essentially two split navigation seasons on the Missouri River the past 2 years in a row, and the barge industry didn't die because of that.
The Corps of Engineers is in the process of reevaluating how it will operate dams on the upper Missouri River. It must work with the Wildlife Service in making any changes in order to comply with the Endangered Species Act. For NPR News, I'm Matt Hackworth in Kansas City.
Senator John Kerry has loaned $850,000 to his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination. Kerry's campaign says the Massachusetts Democrat will also mortgage his home in Boston to raise cash. Kerry was the front runner early in the race, but has lost ground to former Vermont Governor Howard Dean. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
The Simpsons may be just the funniest show on TV. In October, we featured an excerpt of the interview I had just recorded with Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. Today, we bring you the full interview. As Jordan Raphael wrote in the LA Times, The Simpsons not only paved the way for a rich collection of primetime animation shows, it raised the bar for all TV sitcoms. Matt Groening also created the animated series Futurama, and he draws the syndicated comic strip Life in Hell. Before he started cartooning, Groening was a rock critic. Now he's the guest editor of the new book, Best Music Writing of 2003. It's part of an annual series collecting the finest writing on rock, pop, jazz, country, and more, published by DiCapo. This year, Groening curated the second annual All Tomorrow's Parties Rock Festival, which was held last month in Long Beach, California. One of the groups that performed was the Magic Band, which used to be Captain Beefheart's band. Inviting them to perform meant a lot to Groening.
The band that meant the most to me when I was in high school was Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. The album Trout Mask Replica, which came out in 1969, was a double album, and at the time I was on quite a limited budget. I basically only was able to buy records by saving up my lunch money. And this was a two-record set, so it cost, $4? So that took me a while to save up for that. And but I bought the record because it was produced by Frank Zappa, another one of my heroes. And the first time I heard this album, I thought, they're not even trying. This is just a bunch of meaningless psychedelic nonsense and sloppy music. And then I realized about the third time I listened to it, because, you know, back then, if you bought a record, even if you hated it, you had to keep on playing it because I had so few records in my collection. I realized it was horrible, but they meant what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then about the fifth or sixth time, I went, wait a minute, this is great. This is the greatest album I've ever heard. And my friend Richard Gere, who later on went on to be a rock critic himself for the Village Voice, he and I used to run around. We'd run punishment laps during gym class, and we would sing the lyrics to Trout Mask Replica and say, this is the greatest album of 1984. This is back in 1969. And we thought, if this is how great pop music is in 1969, just think how great it's going to be in the future. And I don't think this album has ever been beaten. So anyway, the backing band, the Magic Band, the band that's responsible for the sound, they're back together, or in a unique configuration with John French on drums. He was back then, his name was Drumbo. He's leading this band, and they've recorded an album of their rehearsals, which is fantastic. I was there to hear it, and it's mind-blowing, and it's great. And I'd love to play one of their songs if we could.
Oh, that'd be great. What do you want to play?
Let's see. I've got the new album here. It's called Back to the Front, and it's basically just recreations of their classic songs. I think we should try a song called Steal Softly Through Snow. Hey!
That's the Magic Band, which I guess Matt Groening has brought with him. And by the way, what's Captain Beefheart himself up to?
Don Van Vliet is painting full-time and doesn't do interviews very much. He's had some health problems, and he, from what I understand, is he's painting. If you look on the internet, you find out about various art shows that he has, but he seems to be completely withdrawn from the music scene.
Oh.
But you know what? This band, the love of the musicians and the intensity of enthusiasm on the part of the fans for this music is just amazing. Not everybody gets it. I don't expect to have any instant converts, but give it a chance, because I think it's some of the most amazing music ever done for a rock band. I mean, it's a combination of some of the heartfelt depth of feeling that you get from the Delta Blues combined with the rhythms of Igor Stravinsky. And I know that might sound pretentious, but it's there, and I think you should give it a chance.
My guest is Matt Groening, and he's the creator of The Simpsons, and now he's edited a new book called The DiCapo Best Music Writing Anthology of 2003. It's a series that comes out annually, and this is the new edition. Why did you agree to do this slightly out of character book on the best music writing of 2003?
Well, I have a guilty secret. I used to be a rock critic back in prehistory. I moved to Los Angeles and fell in love with the burgeoning punk scene and started writing about bands that no one ever heard of. Even at the time, they had not heard of them, and they're lost to the sands of history right now. Grandpa Becomes a Fungus. You ever heard of him?
No.
You don't have their records? They're great.
Do you still have yours?
I don't think they ever even put one out. but I would review bands that, you know, I'd have one little 45, and then I'd go into the record store the following week after my review had been published. I'd go, you sell any? No. No, they didn't sell any. So I wasn't that good as a rock critic.
Well, I'm going to ask you to choose one piece. One of the pieces that you've decided to include in the best music writing of 2003. Just tell us what you liked about the piece.
Well, I really liked a piece from The Onion. It seems like this Da Capo best music writing anthology, every year they have a piece from the newspaper The Onion. And this one is, let me find it here.
In fact, why don't you read the first paragraph of it? And before you read it, I'm going to say for any listeners who aren't familiar with it, The Onion is a satirical magazine.
Yes, the headline is 37 Record Store Clerks Fear Dead in Yola Tango Concert Disaster. Dateline, Athens, Georgia. 37 record store clerks are missing and fear dead in the aftermath of a partial roof collapse during a Yola Tango concert Monday. Quote, we're trying to do our best to rescue these clerks, but realistically, there's not a lot of hope, said emergency worker Len Guzman, standing outside the 40-watt club where the tragedy occurred. These people are simply not in the physical condition to survive this sort of trauma. It's just a twisted mass of black frame glasses and ironic Girl Scouts t-shirts in there. Unquote. And I can relate.
Yeah,
I can relate.
Right.
You would have been because I wear glasses and, you know, I had the hip stubble and the bad haircut and the blurry eyes and the hearing loss and that vague sensation that my career choice was ridiculous. And, of course, the empty wallet that goes being with, you know, writing for alternative news weeklies.
And you went to concerts that only people who worked at record stores would go to.
Yes, exactly. And I used to work at a record store, too, and it was miserable. This is, again, during the punk years, which was simultaneous with the disco years. So I got to sell a lot of records up on Sunset Strip at a store called Licorice Pizza to punks and then drug paraphernalia, because they actually sold drug paraphernalia in this record store to the rock stars of the day, little amber vials. And I said, what do you do with these vials anyway? And they didn't answer.
Now, you've said that as a kid you used to tape record your own imaginary program called The Matt Groening Show, which had the Matt Groening Orchestra performing the Matt Groening theme song. What was the theme song?
First you hear a mighty cheer, then you know that Groening's here. Then a streak of color flashes on the ground. You know it's not a train or a comet or a plane. You know it must be Matt Groening, cool guy. Matt Groening. There's more. Come on, don't laugh.
Keep going.
Oh, God, I can't believe I'm doing this. Matt Groening. Okay. I guess just have to say before I do this, I did sing this for my fellow classmates in 1966, and so to do it again after the humiliation that followed my singing is quite remarkable. This is like another bad dream. here we go. Matt Groening. Matt Groening, not a coward, superpowered Matt Groening. Coolest guy there is in town, coolest guy around. Now, you have to understand that everybody in my class after this, although they made fun of me, also made up their own theme songs. Although every single song had the lyrics, coolest guy in town, coolest guy around. The girls didn't do it, by the way. It's just the boys.
No,
the girls were too cool.
Right. Now, should I think that the coolest guy part was said with some degree of irony?
I think I didn't know the word irony, but yes, unconsciously, we were making fun of the idea of thinking highly of oneself. Although, well, we did think highly of ourselves.
Right.
You know. It was pre-adolescent narcissism.
My guest is Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. He's the guest editor of the new anthology, The Best Music Writing 2003. It's an annual collection published by DiCapo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons.
March, what's my blood type?
A positive.
Oh, nuts. Extremely rare blood, and I don't have it.
You know his blood type? How romantic.
My mother knows everything about her family.
Oh, yeah? What's my shoe size?
4B.
How many teeth do I have?
16 permanent, 8 baby.
How many hairs on my head, without looking?
Oh, homie, you have lots of hair. Why did you want to know your blood type?
Oh, old man Burns is going to kick off if he doesn't get some double O negative blood, but nobody at the plant has it.
Bart does?
Woo! Yes! All right! Woo! Congratulations, boy! You've got a date with the needle!
Hey, wait a minute.
Well, Matt Groening, I'd like to talk with you about The Simpsons. And, you know, we spoke just as The Simpsons was becoming coming into existence, starting first as a Tracy Ullman series. And I think we spoke just as it was about to be broadcast on its own. And a lot has happened since then. Simpsons have taken over the world since then. I'm wondering how your vision of the characters compares, how the characters as they are now compare with the vision you had when you were creating them?
Well, here's the problem with doing a sitcom which has lasted more than 300 episodes is you're trying not to repeat yourself. You're trying to surprise the audience, and you're trying to keep everybody works on the show surprised. As a result, the show has gone off in some very peculiar directions. Sometimes I was alarmed. I was going, oh, my God, we can't do this. And then it turns out to be okay. It's funny. It's crazy. And it's the show is so fast-paced. We learned as we went along that we can cram a lot of jokes in there. So if there's a joke you don't like, just wait a fraction of a second, and there'll be another one to come along to replace it. It's still a lot of fun. The writers love doing the show. The animators are still around. We've got one of the directors, Mark Kirkland, who's done 51 episodes himself. He holds the record for animation directors. A lot of the writers have been around for years. And then we got these young guys, mostly guys, who have grown up on the show. That's really demoralizing for me. We've got some little kids working on the show now.
You said that there were things to which you said, we can't do this. What's an example of that? Because let's face it, The Simpsons does a lot of satire about homosexuality, the church, violence on television.
At the beginning, virtually anything we did would get somebody upset. And now it seems like the people who who are eager to be offended, and this country is full of people who are eager to be offended. They've given up on our show. So if you're bothered by The Simpsons by now, you know to tune out. And so we don't get that much problem anymore. We do sometimes with advertisers. We got into trouble a few years ago for Homer's watching an anti-drinking commercial, and it said, "Warning, beer causes rectal cancer." And Homer responds by saying, beer. Fox didn't want us to do that because beer advertisers are a big part of the Fox empire. And it turns out that the writer was able to track down the actual fact where some study showed that indeed it does or did or has a tendency to. So we were able to keep that in. But they want that's the kind of thing we put up with.
One of my favorite episodes is where Homer goes to rock and roll fantasy camp. It's kind of like baseball fantasy camp, but instead of being on a fantasy baseball team, you're in a rock and roll band. And, you know, he's taught, you know, how to be a guitar hero. And like Keith Richards and who else was in the...
Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger, yeah. Elvis Costello. Their voices.
Elvis Costello, Lenny Kravitz. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. You know, what's great on this show is because we basically can get pretty much whoever we want to. And for a while, we weren't able to get older Hollywood stars, but then their grandchildren started telling them to do the show, so we've gotten some of them, too. And that's how we got Ernest Borgnine and Sting. No. Kidding about Sting. Sting said his kids liked it. That's why he did the show.
Were you in on the writing of the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp episode?
You know, I think I was I stuck my nose in the door, but the writers definitely deserve credit for the show. The show has so many things that need to be taken care of. The writing is the least of our problems, and so I run around. I work on the editing for a little bit, and sometimes the writing and the designs but not on that particular episode. I don't think I had anything in there.
Tell me more about what your job is now.
I'm the spokesmodel for the show. I do fresh air interviews, and what I do is like I said, I stick my nose in where I think it's needed.
Uh-huh.
I'm there at the beginning of the process, and I'm there at the end of the process, and it's most fun on Thursday mornings when the actors all get together around a big table on the Fox lot and read and perform the script for the first time while the writers furiously scribble notes and mark little check marks on what gets laughs and what doesn't. And then we rewrite the script. And then 6 months goes by with storyboards and animatics and character designs and re-records and rewrites and all this stuff. And at the very end of the process, there's a final edit and a final sound mix of the show, and it's amazing how many times the show really doesn't come together until that last part of the process, which is the final sound mix, which is one of my favorite parts of the whole thing.
Why do you love that part?
Well, because you can take something that if you watch silently would not get a laugh, and if you, with the right sound effects and the right music and the right pauses, actually, you can pull comedy out of something that didn't seem to be there. We had once, a few years ago, we had a vicious fist fight between Homer and Smithers. I know it's hard to believe that Homer and Smithers would fight, but they did. They got into a fist fight and were hitting each other over the head with blunt instruments like telephones and things. And in listening to it back and watching the animation, it wasn't funny. It just didn't get a laugh. It was horrifying. And what we tried all sorts of experiments to try to make it funny, you know, crazier sound effects and this and that. And finally what we did is we pulled out all the sounds of exertion. So when Homer clonks Smithers on the head with a phone, he goes, ugh! And we took that out and we left in the Smithers sound of pain. And for some reason, the sound of pain, the sound of outrage, the sound of injury is funny, and the sound of anger and aggression is creepy and scary, and it's really funny.
You said that you know, you go over the script and make check marks next to everything that gets a laugh. Who is getting the laugh from? Is it the other writers, or do you do this in front of a test audience?
Well, there are people who come to these table reads who are not writers. Writers all sit around one end of the table and just, you know, are listening, you know, have their heads tilted and see see what gets a laugh from the guests in the room. And there's a lot of people who work on the Fox lot who sneak in and they generally sit along one wall. And we call it the sour wall because they're often sitting there with their arms crossed, disapproving and shaking their heads at certain jokes. But if we can get the sour wall to laugh, then it's a good script.
Matt Groening is the creator of The Simpsons. He's guest editor of the new anthology Best Music Writing 2003, an annual collection of writing on rock, pop, jazz, country, and more, published by DiCapo. Greening will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Live from Springfield Penitentiary's fabulous big open area in cell block D, it's the Krusty the Clown Prison Special.
I slugged some jerk in Tahoe. They gave me 1-3. My high-priced lawyer sprung me on a technicality. I'm just visiting Springfield Prison. I get to sleep at home tonight. Hey, I kid cause I love. I tell you, the best folk in the world are prison folk.
Man, those clowns love Krusty. Inside every hardened criminal beats the heart of a 10-year-old boy.
And vice versa.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From Starbucks, offering access to NPR holiday programming through the T-Mobile Hotspot service, available at neighborhood Starbucks during this holiday season. And by Universal Pictures, presenting Seabiscuit, based on the true story of an American legend, starring Tobey Maguire, Jeff Bridges, and Chris Cooper. Available on DVD and video. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead recommends several jazz collections as holiday gifts, and Matt Groening tells us how some of the supporting characters on The Simpsons were created. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, Futurama, and the syndicated comic strip Life in Hell. He's the guest editor of the new anthology Best Music Writing 2003, an annual collection of the year's finest writing on rock, pop, jazz, country, and more, published by DiCapo. Let's hear a scene from The Simpsons. Krusty the Clown has been invited to the Simpsons house for dinner.
Krusty, would you do the honors?
Well, all right. I'm a little rusty, but I'll try. Baruch hata Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, hamotzi lechem, min haaretz.
Oh, he's talking funny talk.
No, Dad, that's Hebrew. Krusty must be Jewish.
A Jewish entertainer? Get out of here.
Dad, there are many prominent Jewish entertainers, including Lauren Bacall, Don Shore, William Shatner, and Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks is Jewish?
I want to ask you about some of the characters that didn't exist in the very beginning stages of The Simpsons, starting with Krusty the Clown, who's this really funny character. I mean, he's basically like an old vaudevillian type. He's kind of really bitter and Jewish, like a lot of comics, and but this is like an old style Jewish comic dash clown. What did you think of Krusty when he was first created?
Well, Krusty was based on a TV show clown who I grew up with in Portland, Oregon, named Rusty Nails. Rusty Nails was a Christian clown. He was he had his own show, and he showed old Three Stooges shorts. And he was great, and he wasn't like Rusty at all. He was very nice guy, and a very sweet clown. But he had that name, Rusty Nails, which I found incredibly disturbing as a child. Because, you're supposed to avoid Rusty Nails. So... So the idea of a clown named Rusty Nails.
You were a sensitive little kid.
Clowns are scary to begin with. And even though this was a nice clown, I was slightly perturbed by him. Anyway, so Krusty the Clown, Krusty rhymes with Rusty, and I actually created him as a little on-screen character on the Tracy Ullman show for those little shorts there. And the idea of the design of him is he actually is basically... originally Homer in clown garb, and the satirical conceit that I was going for at the time was that the Simpsons was about a kid who had no respect for his father but worshipped a clown who looked exactly like his father. So but we sort of lost that, and I didn't make Krusty Jewish. That was Jay Kogan and Wally Walidarsky, I think, came up with that idea. Two of the old Simpsons writers, and then the rest is, he's one of the richest characters on the show. In fact, this year we have Krusty having his bar mitzvah, finally. Turns out he... And it's a pretty wild show.
Okay, let's talk about Itchy and Scratchy. And this is the recurring cartoon that Bart and Lisa watch on TV. And it's the kind of like super violent version of all the cat and mouse kind of cartoons. How'd you come up with this?
Well, it was from watching cat and mouse cartoons growing up. Pixie and Dixie, the Hanna-Barbera mice, and Tom and Jerry in particular. Very, very violent and very, very funny cartoons, MGM cartoons. And the fantasy was seeing, wanting these cartoons to extend their violence even more. And so with Itchy and Scratchy, it's probably as extreme as it can get for a cat and mouse cartoon. And it's been really fun, because it turns out, the way these shows come together, that whatever the theme of that particular episode is of The Simpsons, there's some Itchy and Scratchy cartoon that obliquely relates to it. They're very hard to write now. They're we've done so many of them that they're harder and harder to write. And originally, of the actors, Harry Shearer, a sophisticated guy, he seemed to laugh the hardest at Itchy and Scratchy during the table reads. I don't know if he's the voice of Itchy or Scratchy, but he's the voice of one of them. He talks like that. Dan Castellaneta is the voice of the other one, the cat or the mouse. I don't know. I sometimes have difficulty remembering which is the cat. And then I go, oh, Scratchy, because he scratches. That's how I figure it out.
So did you were you in on the writing of the Itchy and Scratchy theme song?
That was obvious. It's by the way, it's not, everybody thinks it's they fight and fight and fight and fight and fight. It's not. It's they fight and bite and fight and fight and bite.
Do you remember the theme for Rough and Ready?
No, I don't. I loved Rough and Ready, another great Hanna-Barbera cartoon, but I don't remember.
Because the bridge was, sometimes they have their little spats. They even fight like dogs and cats, et cetera, et cetera. I was wondering if this was an homage to that at all, but I guess not.
I do have a lot of cartoon themes running through my head. In fact, over the years, I wake up out of a deep sleep with a specific theme running through my head. It's the end of, and again, a local Portland, Oregon kids show, Heck Harper. He was a cowboy, and he used to sing, "Sadly now we bid adieu to all our barnyard friends. Rocky and Bullwinkle and Mr. Magoo, Felix and Popeye, I'll say toodaloo," or something like that. That's as far as I remember. But I wake up to that lots and lots of times. It's really, really...
sad.
A cause for concern.
Well, I think it's time to hear the Itchy and Scratchy theme song. Let's hear it. The Itchy and Scratchy theme song from The Simpsons. My guest Matt Groening created The Simpsons. He also just edited the new book, The DiCapo Best Music Writing Anthology of 2003, a collection of the best music writing of the year, as selected by Matt Groening. Yeah.
The lyrics to that were written by Sam Simon, one of the original producers who developed the show, along with Jim Brooks, and basically set the tone for the show.
Okay, I have to ask you now about Troy McClure. I love the name, just like Troy Donahue and Doug McClure. A kind of like washed-up former handsome actor who's never been in really important movies. Can you talk about the creation of Troy McClure?
Well, Troy McClure was, he's a stand-in for a lot of exactly what you said, washed-up phony baloney Hollywood actors. And Phil Hartman, the great, late great Phil Hartman, played Troy McClure and Lionel Hutz and a few other characters on the show. And what's great about Phil Hartman was that you could give him any line and he could figure out a way of pulling the maximum amount of humor out of it. And not only that, he was just a great person. It's easy to say that about people who have passed on, but I think everybody on the show would agree that Phil Hartman was always a delight to work with. And because he's gone, we have retired those characters. We don't want to revoice them.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, sure.
So, yeah.
Well, can I share my favorite Troy McClure moment? And I think this is a lot of people's favorite Troy McClure moments. He is engaged to one of Marge's sisters, and the sister knows that there's some kind of sexual secret that he's keeping from her, and she thinks that the secret is he's gay. But he says, "Do you want to do the line?"
I don't remember.
Oh, he says, "Gay, I wish." it turns out he has a really weird sexual fetish. That is an example of the type of thing that The Simpsons really gets away with. It's a kid show on the one hand, or at least a lot of kids watch it. A lot of adults watch it, too. But there's this really funny sexual humor on it.
What's the fetish? I don't remember. Was it
fish? Oh, I don't even remember either. I think it's a fish thing, yeah. It was just some kind of weird thing, but...
Yeah, that's the... Fish. That would make sense.
So, right, exactly. So, I mean, do you ever get any problems coming back at you as a result of humor like that?
Well, you know, stuff that's so far-fetched like that is, we don't get much problem with that. We deal with various sexual aspects of contemporary culture, and what I try to hope that we do is that the stuff that's not appropriate for kids, they don't get. Again, the idea of The Simpsons always has been that it's a show for everybody, that is, for all ages, and not every joke is for every person. In fact, I always said, well, the dumb jokes, the ones that you don't think are funny, those are for the kids. And the sophisticated ones, you know, the references to... Dostoevsky and so on, those are for the grown-ups. And so the idea is to basically redefine family entertainment and do stuff for the entire family that you can all stand to sit there and watch. And how much of TV can you say that about? Most TV is so fragmented in the demographic uh, that it, that it's trying to get to, that, you know, there's very few things that that I can watch that my kids dig. So, but they do like The Simpsons.
My guest is Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. He's the guest editor of the new anthology, Best Music Writing 2003, this year's finest writing on rock, pop, jazz, country, and more. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. He's also the guest editor of the new book, Best Music Writing 2003. One of the characters is Ned Flanders. He's the Simpsons' born-again neighbor. And, you know, so the kids in the Flanders household are being brought up very differently than the kids in the Simpsons household. Can you talk about the creation of Ned Flanders?
At first, Ned Flanders was just the wacky neighbor. And then we decided that wouldn't it be fun if he were actually a good person. Homer hates him for no good reason. He was actually just a good guy, and Homer just misunderstands him completely. And then we realized that he was an object of mirth with his strong religious feelings. We thought, how do we create a religious character who is not the usual stereotype? And we made him a truly good guy, and his beliefs are sometimes a little annoying, but he's not a hypocrite. He's real, and we get lots of fan mail for him, and we get lots of photos of people who look exactly like Ned Flanders. Some people think Michael Medved is a Ned Flanders clone. So,
because he looks.
And I love the character. Harry Shearer does the voice, and he does such a fantastic job with finding variations on Oakley Dokley. And I think we treat the character with some dignity. On the show, we have people of all political stripes and religions, and everybody sticks up for Flanders' dignity. And when Flanders tried to have the kids baptized, he took it upon himself, because one time the Simpsons were such terrible parents that
they swapped children.
The children got sent to
Ned Flanders' home,
right,
for
and
a better
Flanders
upbringing.
Found out that they had never been baptized, so he took them down to the river, and Homer and Marge found out, and Homer was extremely disturbed and said, we've got to save them, and it was a big it was a big race against time. And at the very end, Homer dives in the water, and as the holy water spills and drips on Homer, he's zapped, and he writhes like a Japanese movie monster, like Godzilla, because the holy water stings him so badly. And I don't know what our point was, but I guess we've actually shown God on the show too. In our version of God, we never show his face, but he's a big guy. With yellow skin and five fingers. That's the difference between him and The Simpsons, is he actually has five fingers. and I have to say, we're the only sitcom on TV that has a family who goes to church. They say grace. They believe in God. They pray. We actually show God. And yet, some religious conservatives are unhappy with the show.
Now, I'd love to hear what it's like in the writing room. And one of my fantasies is that people, each of the writers has this kind of file of like jokes and satires that they're just saving for the right moment, because each episode is so rich with jokes and little parodies of TV shows and commercials. And do you just have like a file of that stuff that you pull out when for when it's appropriate?
One of the reasons why I think so many comedy writers are from Ivy League colleges, in the Simpsons case, Harvard, is because they're so smart that they carry the files in their head. And the way TV is written, there's no time for research or taking a walk around the block and thinking about it. People are just racing through it. And the writers have an incredible amount of knowledge, you know, rolling around in their heads that they're able to call forth. So, I mean, that's where that comes from. But the writing process in and of itself is not very glamorous. I mean, sitting around in the room with a bunch of writers, looking as bored as possible, with their feet up on the table, their arms folded, or some people are lying on the couch, you know, and it goes, it's many, many, many hours long. So you really get to know your coworkers. And there's lots of horrible snacks in the the room next door when people get nervous and yep, that's it. That's the writer's room.
The last time you were on Fresh Air, David Bianculli was guest hosting, our TV critic, and one of the things you said to him was that The Simpsons is about the anxiety and consternation of living with people who drive you out of your mind. How do you live with people you love and you want to kill? Do you still see it that way?
Wow. That sounds really smart.
Doesn't it?
that sounds true. That sounds like... Sounds like you're in a court and you're saying, "Did you say the following?" That's what it's about. I mean, that's at the core. It's about being in a family, and families drive you crazy. So nothing changes about that. We can all relate to that, I'm sure.
Does that statement that I just read describe your family too?
Except for my family. Come on, what do you think? You know, my family hears this. And by the way, that interview that you mentioned, that was repeated a number of times, and I actually heard it with my kids in the car driving.
What was that like?
And it was a very odd sensation. And, uh-huh. Of course, they, you know, they take me to task for everything. And they're my most honest critics and... you know, they give notes on the show and even more so on the other cartoon show that I've been working on, Futurama. They were there from the beginning. The Simpsons came along before they were born, but Futurama came along when they were at the age where they felt like their opinions needed to be noted. And they give me color notes and all sorts of stuff.
How would you do The Simpsons differently if you had already had children when you were creating it? Because The Simpsons is in some ways like from the point of view of the kids.
Well, you know, what I get from my kids is more the way kids really talk and more what's on their mind. And in fact, I definitely exploit my kids. I have a weekly comic strip called Life in Hell, which runs in alternative news weeklies around the country. And I often quote my kids. I just actually sit there and take notes on their conversations at the dinner table and run them in my strip and hope that they don't sue me. No, they dig it, although they're old. Now they're 12 and 14, and they're much less cooperative about letting me write down what they say. But when they were younger, I got lots of material out of them.
Uh-huh. Matt Groening, so great to talk to you. Thank you very, very much.
Always a pleasure, Terry. Great show.
Matt Groening is the creator of The Simpsons. He's the guest editor of the new book, Best Music Writing 2003, an annual collection published by Tekapo. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some holiday gift recommendations. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says when you give someone records for Christmas, they may put that music on right away, just to be polite. So you might want to avoid giving music that'll jangle the family's nerves. In hopes of lending a calming presence to this holiday season, he recommends three sets that are easy on the ears and, in one case, the eyes.
Count Basie's peerless rhythm section and tenor saxophonist Lester Young on Oh Lady Be Good, 1936. Fair to say Basie's band taught the swing era how swing was swung, and their pulsing momentum is still a model for jazz rhythm. Plus, the full band's streamlined, revved-up blues all but handed us R&B and rock and roll. Trumpeter Sweets Edison on 1945's Avenue C. It's in the Count Basie anthology, America's number one band, a 4-CD set on Columbia with more than enough great and good music to make a prudent gift, even if the selection is kind of lopsided. On the plus side, it has everything the label owns by Basie's smaller groups, including a Little Herd 1950 octet, a miniaturized version of the big band. Basie's orchestra was his main focus, but this box has only a quarter of its 150 Columbia studio sides. There'd have been room for a couple of dozen more, but instead we get a full disc of less essential live stuff, rather than benchmarks like Blowtop, The World is Mad, and I'm Gonna Move to the Outskirts of Town, or either of bebop pioneer Kenny Clarke's guest shots on drums. Clarke does turn up on another 4-CD box, the Modern Jazz Quartet's complete Prestige and Pablo recordings. Modern Jazz Quartet learned a lot from Basie about keeping a clean profile and swinging with a light stick. Lighter than that after colorist Connie Kay came in on drums. There's something genteel and self-consciously arty about the MJQ, but much of the stuff sounds surprisingly fresh and oddly Christmassy. Milt Jackson's vibes shimmer and flicker like a decorated tree. Like the Basie set, the MJQ box misses a lot. The first third was recorded before 1956, and the rest is divided between live and studio dates from the 80s. That leaves out their most popular years when they recorded for Atlantic. But the early stuff really crackles, especially when Sonny Rollins sits in for four tunes, and they still sound crisp on the late studio dates. Composer John Lewis had a playful way with form and knew how to make even clunkers sound pretty. That's Lewis on piano and Percy Heath on bass. Those notes in collision recall Thelonious Monk, who, like Basie, knew how to say more with less, making a few odd piano notes swing like crazy. There's plenty of live Monk out there, and recent Monk reissues, but his quartet's especially hot on Monk in Paris, Live at the Olympia, recorded in 1965 and out on the Monk family's Thelonious Records. Charlie Rouse has a field day on tenor sax, and Monk gives him plenty of room to run with bassist Larry Gales and drummer Ben Riley. Monk's Live at the Olympia is a two-disc set, the Paris CD, plus a DVD of the same quartet in Oslo a year later. That concert's less brilliant, but you get to watch Monk at work at the keyboard and see the complex crossed hands fingerings he devised to get at the pretzel chords he heard in his head. Pop that in on the big holiday, and it's sure to happily occupy those family members who enjoy arguing about what to watch on TV.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with writer André Debus III. His best-selling novel, House of Sand and Fog, has been adapted into a new film starring Jennifer Connelly and Ben Kingsley. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.